A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Happy Friday the 13th to you. This has been like a week of Friday the 13th. Now, coming up on the program today, we're going to get to some of your emails. We have our good deed of the day. We've got an armed citizen story for you, recidivist report. Want to get to a couple of headlines as well, though, before we get to your emails. The coronavirus is obviously having an incredible impact on our day-to-day lives now with, you know, the closures of or the postponement of virtually all, you know, major league professional sporting teams, college athletics, a number of states. In fact, I think at this point, a majority of states around the country have declared states of emergency. So large gatherings may be curtailed where you live. I know we've got St. Patrick's Day coming up next week and a lot of St. Patrick's Day celebrations and, you know, bar crawls and things of that nature over the weekend have been canceled. And that means that we are starting to see some cancellations of some pretty big events in the world of the Second Amendment. The National Rifle Association announcing on Thursday night that the 149th annual meeting scheduled for April 16th through the 19th in Nashville, Tennessee, has been canceled. Yeah. A note on the NRA's website says, "We realize that many NRA members and meeting guests have questions about the coronavirus and the potential impact on our convention. We've been closely monitoring updates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Tennessee Department of Health. In fact, earlier today, meaning earlier Thursday, a state of emergency was declared in Tennessee. Therefore, we have reluctantly decided to cancel this year's NRA annual meeting planned for April 16th through the 19th in Nashville. This applies to all events and scheduled programs, including the NRA ILA Forum. We sincerely regret the need for this action, particularly for our many loyal members who join us for this annual celebration of the NRA and our constitutional freedoms. Details regarding a rescheduled NRA members meeting will be forthcoming." Now, a members meeting is a small portion of the annual meetings. When they talk about rescheduling the members meeting, they're not talking about rescheduling the whole event. The members meeting takes place on Saturday morning at the annual meeting. It is required under the bylaws of the NRA to have this members meeting where the announcements for the elections for board are held, new businesses discussed, and things of that nature. So under the bylaws of the NRA, that meeting has to take place. The last time that the NRA annual meeting was canceled was Denver, Colorado, 1999. And this was a few weeks after the Columbine shootings. And the NRA canceled its members meeting, but had to proceed with its members meeting under the bylaws. And the media, by the way, ripped them. "Oh, they wouldn't even cancel their meeting." Well, they did cancel basically everything but the stuff that was required under the bylaws. Not that the media gave them any credit for that. So at some point, this members meeting is going to have to take place. But the annual meeting, unfortunately, will not. The NRA says, under the direction of NRA President Carolyn Meadows, the NRA Board of Directors is working with the Office of the Secretary in relation to board elections, meetings, and the like. "Please know," the organization says, "that we did not reach this decision lightly. We were ultimately guided by our responsibility to help ensure the safety and well-being of our NRA members, guests, and surrounding community. Please coordinate directly with any hotels, airlines, or others who have assisted you with your travel arrangements. Most companies have announced plans to accommodate travelers dealing with event cancellations. And please visit NRAAM.org for additional news and information regarding NRA activities. Thank you for your understanding and your continued support." I got to tell you, I am disappointed to see this, but I understand completely. I think that, first of all, even if the NRA had wanted to proceed with this, it would have been very, very difficult, if not downright impossible to do, given the state of emergency that has been declared in the state of Tennessee. But also just from a logistical standpoint, you're talking about 80,000 or so individuals coming into the downtown Nashville area from all around the country and really all around the globe. So at a time of a pandemic, having 80,000 people, many of them from outside of the city and outside of the state coming in, that's a problem in and of itself. If you've ever been to an NRA annual meeting, you know that, I mean, I call it the world's biggest family reunion. I love going to the NRA annual meeting every year. But one of the things that you realize pretty quickly is if you're in a hurry at the NRA annual meeting, you're out of luck. You really are, because the there again, 80,000 people there. The aisles can get kind of congested at times. You are not 6 feet away from people. You're not 3 feet away from people. You're sort of, you know, rear ends to elbows as you're walking through the aisles of the convention center. The NRA ILA Forum draws thousands of attendees. The NRA ILA dinner draws thousands. The NRA Foundation banquet draws hundreds of folks. So you've got within this, you know, big crowd of 80,000 people who are there for a weekend, you've got all sorts of little breakout sessions and other events that are coinciding or taking part as part of this convention that also are going to have thousands of people taking part in those events. So I get it. I understand. I like you. I am disappointed. I was at Nashville in 2015 was one of my favorite NRA annual meetings of all time. The city was great. The convention center was at that point even a little small for the NRA annual meeting. So they moved some events out into the street. You had vendors out in the street, almost had this open air feel to it. It was fantastic. I loved it. The weather was great. It was great crowds. I've been looking forward to going back to Nashville for a couple of years. And I hope that the NRA is able to get back there very soon. I know that it's going to be on the schedule for upcoming annual meetings, but it's a shame, but it's an understandable shame that the NRA annual meeting has been canceled. We'll give you any details on to as to when the members meeting will be held. But I can also tell you that I think the coronavirus is starting to have an impact on our right to keep our arms in other ways. We've seen a number of stories about, particularly out in California, Asian Americans who are buying firearms. They're concerned about being the victim of a hate crime, basically. You know, the one of the sad things that we've seen with the spread of the coronavirus is finger pointing. Right. And so China is now engaged in this propaganda campaign to try to make it seem like the coronavirus came from the United States as opposed to originating in Wuhan province. Yeah. And so you got this, you know, kind of ugly attempt now to point fingers on who's responsible for this when you know, pretty clearly this case originated in China. Now, that does not mean that Asian Americans are more susceptible or are disease vectors. That's absolutely absurd. The idea that we would target any of our fellow Americans because of our fear over this coronavirus is abhorrent. But I do understand the desire to want to protect yourself in a time of fear and uncertainty. So we're seeing that increase in firearm sales, supposedly among Asian Americans out in California, but I think it's more broad than that. And I ran across a story earlier today from West Virginia, Ohio County, West Virginia. This is the first story like this that I've seen, but I have a sneaking suspicion it's not going to be the last. Ohio County, West Virginia Sheriff's Department has suspended concealed carry applications and renewals until at least April the 10th. Because of coronavirus fears. I spoke with somebody in the office there at the sheriff's department. And basically, because of the physical layout of that office, the folks within the office are coming into close contact with individuals who may be infected. And they want to make sure that their deputies don't get sick. You know, it's very important that the frontline responders stay as healthy as possible during a pandemic like this. So they, too, are disappointed. They, too, want to get back up to speed as quickly as possible. This will not have a huge impact in the state of West Virginia and in Ohio County because West Virginia is a constitutional carry state. So if you are a concealed carry holder in Ohio County, West Virginia, and your license is going to expire, for example, well, you can still carry. As long as you can legally possess your firearm, you can legally carry it. What you can't do is you can't take the firearm out of state. So any reciprocity agreements that West Virginia has, if you don't have your active concealed carry license, that's going to impact your ability to travel and carry outside of the state of West Virginia. But if you're applying for your license and you're a legal gun owner and your license gets hung up there in Ohio County, that's okay. As long as you're within the state of West Virginia, you can carry. However, again, I suspect that this is going to spread and we're going to see other agencies and other issuing authorities around the country take similar measures. And they may do so in states that are not constitutional carry. And so what happens then if you live in, let's say, Illinois, if you live in Oregon or Washington State? And all of a sudden your sheriff's office says, look, you know, we just can't keep this environment clean and effective, and we need it to be. So until April 15th, we're not accepting more concealed carry applications, and or we're not processing anymore. Then we could start to see, I think, a bigger impact here. You know, this is not something that really was on my radar screen until I saw this story. And then I started thinking about, oh, yeah, how about that? How about concealed carry classes? In Virginia, we've seen recently concealed carry courses that have had several hundred people attend. Well, we've now got a state of emergency in the state of Virginia. So it's possible that big, large-scale concealed carry courses like that could also be impacted in the future. You know, if you've got 15, 25 people, maybe not, maybe so, but certainly those larger scale events, I think, are in trouble. I have to look and see when Mother's Day is this year, because every year around Mother's Day, up in Michigan, our friend Rick Ector, okay, May the 10th. So this is on the bubble here. Our friend Rick Ector has an event that weekend, and they offer free firearms training to women. And last year they had, I know it was over 500 individuals show up. And Rick is really hoping for just record-breaking attendance this year. Again, a lot of these events now sort of on the bubble. By May 10th, are things going to be getting back to normal? I would certainly like to hope so. Can we guarantee that that's going to be the case? No, we cannot. Not at this point. So keep your eyes on any events that are coming up. You know, I would say after April 15th. If you've got something coming up before April 15th, I would plan on that being canceled or postponed. I really would. After that, I think right now we're in sort of a wait and see approach. And the thinking is that with all of this social distancing, with all of us now, a lot of these large gatherings canceled, if we do socially distance ourselves, that we can prevent this dramatic spread of the coronavirus. We can prevent the healthcare system from being overwhelmed, and we'll be able to manage the risks and mitigate the damage far better than if we don't take these steps right now. I'm not a public health expert. I won't pretend to tell you whether or not I agree with that 100%. Certainly, there is an economic impact that comes with this social isolation. And I think that's going to be weighed over time. But we're in it right now. And this is the way things are going to be for at least the next few weeks. And so, again, take a look at your plans, make those adjustments accordingly. And we will get through this. We really will get through this. I promise you that. All right. So let's get to a few of your emails, shall we? Okay, first email. Hang on, I got to get my email up. Here we go. First email from Mark up in Connecticut, talking about the new lawsuit that has been filed challenging the magazine ban in Connecticut, which was passed in 2013 after the Sandy Hook massacre. No more are magazines over the 10-round limit sold in the state. And this was a really bizarre component. So right now, the gun control advocates' MO is basically when they go after magazines now, they've got the California, New Jersey model. We're going to ban not only the future sales and purchase of these magazines, but if you own one of these magazines, turn them in. You got to get rid of them, or you got to permanently modify them so they can't accept more than 10 rounds. That law is on hold in California while it's being challenged in federal court. That law is in place in New Jersey while it's being challenged in federal court. But that's a kind of a new twist. Going back to 2013, in Connecticut, what gun control advocates managed to put on the books was a bill that said, okay, no more are we going to sell these so-called high-capacity magazines. But if you own them, you have to let the state police know that you own these magazines. And then, let's say you've got a 20-round magazine. You are only legally allowed to put 10 rounds in that 20-round magazine. It's bizarre. And it is now the subject of a new court challenge. Mark says, I'd love to hear you chat with Holly Sullivan, the president of the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, a great leader, a super gal. And Connecticut Citizens Defense League involved with this lawsuit along with Second Amendment Foundation. I will actually reach out, Mark, because I would love to talk with Holly about this particular lawsuit in Connecticut and how it is impacting people. I can tell you as well that on Monday's program, we are slated to talk with Dr. James Eric Dietz at Purdue University's Homeland Security Institute. His team has actually been doing research into quote-unquote large-capacity magazines or high-capacity magazines, basically taking a look at magazine capacity and survivability of home invasions. And what the research has shown, and it probably not going to be a huge surprise to gun owners, but it might be a surprise to anti-gun lawmakers, is that the greater the magazine capacity, the greater the chance of survivability in a home invasion. If you are a homeowner using a firearm in self-defense, the larger your magazines, the greater your chances of surviving that encounter with intruders in your home. Given the fact that criminals are not going to obey this law, by their very nature, criminals are not going to say, you know what, I'm going to go out and commit an armed robbery, but I'm going to make sure I have a 10-round magazine when I do. Given the fact that criminals aren't going to do that, this law in Connecticut is impacting, really, the only people that are impacted by this are the legal law-abiding gun owners. And based on this information, based on this research from the Homeland Security Institute at Purdue University, they're being impacted in a negative way because their survivability, their ability to use a firearm in self-defense, is in fact being hindered by this law. Now, that's not the argument that Second Amendment Foundation and Connecticut Citizens Defense League are making. At least that's not the entire argument. They are talking about impacting the Second Amendment rights of Connecticut residents, but they're also talking about how the 14th Amendment rights of these residents are implicated in this law as well. So I'm actually really excited and encouraged to see this law. Hopefully by the time it gets up to the Supreme Court, we're going to have some guidance from the Supreme Court. Don't forget, we still have New York State Rifle and Pistol Association that is before the Supreme Court. Oral arguments were held back in December. And we don't know exactly when we're going to get an opinion. Could be as late as June. I think that it is a good sign that we haven't heard from the court yet, because if the court were going to come out and say, well, this case is moot, you know, the question that was raised is now a dead question because the city of New York has changed the law in question. This case really doesn't matter. I think that if we were going to hear the court say that, we would have by now. I mean, that's just my guess. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get an actual honest-to-goodness decision and opinion from the Supreme Court that will hopefully provide some guidance in cases like the one out of Connecticut. John writing in from Virginia with his preparation plans. He says, you've been talking about what the next steps are and what people are doing to prepare for the coronavirus. John says, I have type 2 diabetes and my immune system is compromised. And with that, I have to be cautious since there's not a treatment or a vaccine for this at this time. He says, I've been doing my own research to try to understand how the virus grows, where it grows, how long it takes to die, how it can be transmitted. He says, apparently they don't have studies that show how long it can live on a surface or in the air at this time. And he says, I think the unknown about this virus is adding to the panic. I think you're right about that, John. Fear, right? Fear of the unknown does lead to panic because we don't know what exactly we're afraid of and we don't know how afraid we should be. And so we tend to escalate that fear. I have seen one study that, but it's only one. So keep in mind, another study could come out an hour after I say this and be completely different. But the one study that I've seen, taking a look at how long coronavirus can live on various surfaces, said it could live for several hours in the air, said it could live for several days on stainless steel surfaces, which is something that I've been thinking about because in my kitchen, we have a stainless steel chef's table. So I've been telling my wife, who's also immunocompromised, make sure you're cleaning that as often as you can. First thing that happens when anybody walks through the door of my house now, they go to the kitchen sink, they scrub their hands. That's it. Before you go anywhere else, straight to the kitchen sink, wash those hands with soap and water. John says, I've already seen panic buying, price gouging, the supply chain's impacted. He says, if you look on emergency prepper sites, you see all the out-of-stock items and delayed shipping banners due to increased activity. He said, look at Amazon for N95 masks and the cost increase of them. They're typically $20 for 10 or so. And here's the thing, too. I mean, even with my wife being immunocompromised, I'm not buying any masks. I'm not. I'd have to shave the beard, and I really, really want to avoid doing that. But also, the masks primarily help prevent help you if you're infected from infecting other people, but they don't necessarily do a fantastic job of preventing somebody from infecting you. We also, I've heard from healthcare workers that they are seeing a real shortage of N95 masks, of hand sanitizer. So, you know, look, I live in a rural area. I live on a farm. We are on basically a limited lockdown. My wife and I went to the hospital today for her oncology appointment. We'll be going back there next Friday. Actually, she's probably going to go by herself next Friday because there's no reason for me to go next Friday. We were meeting with the doctors today. But basically, any unnecessary travel outside of my home, we're stopping right now. So I'm not putting in place a, you know, cold, hard rule of I'm not stepping foot off my property. But unless it is an absolute emergency, unless it is an absolute necessity, I'm staying put. That's sort of my plan. And so because I'm limiting myself and because I'm isolating myself socially, I don't feel a huge need to try to grab a bunch of masks. I want those to be available for the doctors and the nurses and the frontline healthcare fighters that are going to need them. We've got a little bit of hand sanitizer, but mostly we're using soap and water. And I'm washing my hands basically every time I walk by a sink, just washing my hands. Even if I haven't left my house, I'm still washing my hands. I'm washing my beard almost as often as I'm washing my hands. And, you know, we're just trying to take those basic steps to keep our house as germ-free and as friendly for my immunocompromised wife as possible. John says, I've put a plan together at my house, and this is as precautionary based on what I know. He said, so I'm limiting contact with other humans. I'm not traveling. I'm working remotely. I've restricted to the house with no visitors. And then he says, these are the contingency operations if a family member gets infected. Cleaning supplies, rubber gloves, masks, a clean room set up with an isolated bathroom, and the house on lockdown to contain the spread. John says, hope all is good on your end and stay strong. Still pulling for you too. John, thank you very much for that. I do appreciate it. You know, the one thing that I've been a little, I don't know, I guess a little lax about at this point. We do live in a rural area. We don't have any visitors. My oldest son has a girlfriend who also lives in the area. She's been at college. She has come home. No sign of any infection or anything of that nature, but like she's probably the one outside person, so to speak, that comes over to the house regularly. And I don't want to tell them, hey, you can't see each other for a month. So what I have been doing is, again, as soon as she comes in the door, take off your shoes so you're not tracking outside germs in the house. And please go straight to the sink, wash your hands for 30 seconds, and then stay away from my wife. That's sort of the MO at our house. And John, that sounds like you have a good plan, sir. I hope that you stay safe. We would love to hear, you know, what you're doing as well to try to stay safe and to try to, you know, mitigate the spread as much as possible. And I'd love to know as well what things are like in your neck of the woods. I was at the grocery store yesterday, just briefly, and in Farmville, as of Thursday, plenty of toilet paper on hand. There were no hand sanitizer, but plenty of soap, paper towels. We had not had our run on the grocery store in Farmville. And I posted a picture online, and then I started seeing responses from folks up in like Northern Virginia, Southern Maryland, the D.C. area, and the shelves were picked clean, just absolutely picked clean. So a very different experience than what we have here in Farmville. Arthur wrote in with a non-coronavirus question. I like those too. Arthur says, I found evidence that it's a federal crime if you break your oath of office. He says, I'd like for you to consider that every official that voted for gun control, red flag law, gun ban, high capacity magazine ban, and other laws have broken their oath. Okay. And Arthur points to some federal laws, 18 U.S. Code 1918, whoever violates the provisions of Section 7311 of Title V, that as an individual may not accept or hold a position in the government of the United States or a government of the District of Columbia. Yes. And all of this, Arthur, is contingent again on those individuals being charged and tried with violating their oath of office. And specifically, what you're looking at is federal law, which would mean that you'd have to have basically an investigation by a U.S. attorney, an indictment handed down by a U.S. attorney or by a grand jury, federal grand jury, and then they'd have to take that case to trial. So is it possible that, you know, federal officials would be arrested and charged with violating their oath of office? Well, it's not just possible. I mean, it happens all the time, you know, but oftentimes it's the underlying crime that they get charged with. So bribery, for example, right? That's a violation of the oath of office. But bribery convictions, I think, are much easier to take care of than, you know, trying to charge somebody with violating their oath of office. When it comes to gun laws, so you got to remember that, you know, until these things are adjudicated in a court, these public officials can say, hey, what we're doing is constitutional. I mean, we're seeing this in Virginia right now. You know, Governor Ralph Northam, when he was still pushing for that Gun Magazine ban, said, listen, no court has ruled these things to be unconstitutional. And he's right. You know, the Supreme Court has not weighed in. Now, that doesn't mean the Supreme Court has said it's okay to ban these guns. The Supreme Court hasn't said anything. The Supreme Court's been silent. The Supreme Court hasn't heard a case on red flag laws. The Supreme Court hasn't heard a case on magazine bans. The Supreme Court has heard, well, now three Second Amendment related cases since 2008. The Heller decision, the McDonald decision, and now New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City. So you're not, I get what you're saying, Arthur, but I'm just as a practical, pragmatic point of view, which is what I try to ascribe to, you're not going to see a bunch of people who vote for gun control laws get arrested and charged with violating their oath of office. You're just not. Now, if you had a bunch of elected officials that were passing laws that put in place a ban on handguns, then maybe you would, because the Supreme Court has said a ban on handguns is unconstitutional. What we are seeing, though, more, Arthur, are politicians who are trying to dance right up to that line of doing something that is unconstitutional. Not necessarily in terms of handgun bans, but in terms of storage laws. That was another component of the Heller case, where the Supreme Court said, look, it's an infringement of people's right to require them to keep their firearms locked up with their ammunition stored separately, because then they can't use them for self-defense. And so since then, we've seen a number of jurisdictions, most recently Alameda, California did this. Say, okay, so you can't require the gun to be locked up with the ammunition stored separately. Well, what about just requiring it to be locked up at all times? Unless you're wearing it. Let's try that. We'll put that law in the books, see what happens. And so they're testing and they're probing and they're seeing what they can get away with. And this is one reason why New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City is such an important case, because it hopefully provides the Supreme Court with the opportunity to lay down some real guidelines and to say, you can't do that. And you can't use intermediate scrutiny as you're reviewing these gun control laws and upholding all these gun control laws. This is a fundamental individual right. Highest level of judicial review is what is necessary. And if that's the case, then a lot of these, you know, ticky-tack little gun laws that are put in place simply to inhibit the exercise of the right to keep and bear arms are going to fall by the wayside. So there you go, Arthur. That's my that's my pragmatic look at this issue. All right, let's get to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, our citivist report. We will start there in Florida, Palm Bay, Florida, where police have charged a 15-year-old, Joseph Howard, with attempted murder after a shooting on Tuesday night. And even at the tender age of 15, Mr. Howard is no stranger to the criminal justice system. He faces now attempted murder charges, armed robbery charges, possession of a firearm by a delinquent, as well as a probation violation. And according to Florida Today, the investigation remains ongoing. That the victim identified Howard in a photo lineup. Police arrested him at his home And Florida Today says, while customarily not naming juveniles accused of crimes, it does name some juveniles depending on the seriousness of the crime, their age, aggravating circumstances, and other factors. Well, given the fact that this individual, among his other charges at age 15, is facing a probation violation, we know that this is not Joseph Howard's first run-in with the law. Because he is a minor, we don't know all of the details of his previous encounters, but possession of a firearm by a delinquent would indicate that there were, again, some underlying and in previous charges that made simple possession of a firearm by a minor an enhancement. Hopefully, the system now treats Joseph Howard seriously, but I don't know that there's a lot of indication that that's going to happen. Now, our armed citizen story of the day from Wisconsin, Fox 11 News out of Green Bay, WLUK, reported that a burglar who was held at gunpoint by an employee until police arrived, sentenced to 1 year in jail, Eric Elm, pleaded no contest last Friday to burglary and obstruction for an incident back in April of last year at Frost Giant Games in Ashwaubenon, Wisconsin. That's a comic book store. Anthony Folk, who's the business owner, and two of his employees were at a nearby fast food restaurant. And when they came back to the store, actually, they were sitting there and they got a phone call from his fiance, said that she saw somebody inside the business on the surveillance cameras. So then Folk went back to the store, turned on the lights. He got to the back of a hallway, saw somebody wearing a black hoodie and a backpack. I chased the person, who was eventually able to get outside. Folk says, I just acted on instinct. Folk and an employee who's a concealed carry holder ended up holding, again, Elm at gunpoint until police arrived and took him into custody. At the time, the Ashwaubenon Public Safety Captain Jody Crocker said, quote, we're very satisfied with what happened. So the situation here was that the burglar could have gotten away. The concealed carry holder did exactly what he should do. There was a felony in progress. He also complied with officers as soon as they arrived and did everything right. Crocker said, quote, concealed carry holders are trained on how and when to use their weapons, and this outcome could not have gone better. Well, now Mr. Elm looking at a year, sentenced to a year behind bars. He's not going to do a year behind bars, but sentenced to a year, and probably learned his lesson not to rob that store anyway when he's back out onto the streets. Our good deed of the day from Massachusetts. This from itemlive.com, the daily item out of the Lynn, Massachusetts area. Maria Gradazzi says she does not consider herself a hero, but a lot of other people do there in the Lynn area. Maria is a bus driver, and she was behind the wheel when she saw a burning home on Wednesday night. She said she lives in Lynn. She had finished her shift. She was driving her bus down Boston Street when she noticed a small flame. At first, she didn't think much about it. She thought maybe someone was just cooking out. But then she saw people start to panic, and she realized that there was a building that was on fire. The 27-year-old said, I can't tell you what overcame me. It was just an instinct. She said, honestly, now that I think about it, I think, what the hell was I thinking running into a burning building? The only thing I was thinking was, were there people in the home, and I wanted to get them out. So she grabbed a fire extinguisher from the bus that she was driving. She ran in. She said she was actually assisted by another Good Samaritan, a guy she doesn't even know. It was just a strange man. As he used her fire extinguisher to try to douse some of the flames, they ran through the three-family home. They rang doorbells. They yelled fire to alert residents that they needed to leave immediately. As the Daily Item says, their efforts likely saved some lives on Wednesday night. The fire quickly spread from that first building to another triple-decker home next door. Both homes were destroyed in a massive four-alarm fire. Two other homes were damaged. Two firefighters sustained minor injuries. A dozen residents were displaced, but nobody was hurt in that blaze. No resident was hurt in that blaze, thanks in part to the efforts of Maria and the other Good Samaritan. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing without even thinking about it. Maybe that was the key. Maria Gradazzi of Lynn, Massachusetts, we thank you for your very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program today. Hope you have a good weekend. Deep breaths. Not too closely to people, but deep breaths. We're going to make it through this. We'll see you back here on Monday with another brand new edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Don't forget, you can subscribe to Town Hall Media at YouTube. Never miss a program. Also, subscribe to Bearing Arms, Cam and Company at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, townhall.com, podcasts, and more. We'll see you soon. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great weekend.